Today is the first day of the Freedom Day retreat. Not sure what the date is. Date after the mighty men gathered.
23rd.
This is wonderful. Everyone just settled in, arrives on time, sits still. Feels as if the train of practice has just slowed down to a stately pace through the platform, so that those who are getting on can just open the door and toss in their winter underwear and biltong snacks. And climb on board, and the train just keeps going. Wonderful. So the daily Dharma talk is your listening practice and my talking practice. And it's something we do together. As much as I have a sense of what I'm wanting to talk about, what appears seems to be something that comes from us all. So watch what you think. And it's just another kind of meditation. The listening practice is just as you pay attention to what you're hearing, it means that you are giving yourself fully to that. That is meditation. Just like during the other meditation sittings, what we call Zazen, you are paying attention to your body or your breath, or your mantra, or whatever your focus of attention is. Now it's just listening. And listening meditation means not measuring everything you hear against what you think. I disagree with this, or could have said this better, or I agree with that, isn't it wonderful? That gets terribly complicated and sort of stilted. So just keep your ears open. As we say in the Heart Sutra, listen with no ears. Listen with no ears. And some of it will trickle inside, some you'll remember in 3 decades, some you won't remember at all. That's fine. That's fine. And from my side, I have to not try and make a memorable speech every morning. I have to somehow speak from inside of this retreat practice, from inside of all of us sitting here in our innocence, our openness, and our great purity. That's the right word. So today there won't be interviews with koans, you'll be relieved to know. we're just all going to sit together, get this train up to speed. Just really spend the day together. And we'll probably do that later in the week as well for one day. Okay. There's a lovely koan, which I'll read to you in a minute, about the Bodhisattva of compassion, the figure of compassion, the mythological representation of the idea of compassion. In the Indian tradition called Avalokiteshvara, Chinese Kuan Yin, Japanese Kanon, I don't remember the names of the other languages where it came to roost. But it's a koan, which is sort of a teaching story about this figure. And of course the hero of the Heart Sutra is the Bodhisattva of compassion, the figure of compassion. Let's chant that every morning. This is the 89th case from the Blue Cliff Record, for those of you that like that sort of information. I'll just read the case. Yun Yin asked Dao Wu, "How does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes?" According to tradition, the Bodhisattva of compassion has 84,000 arms. Not as many as the mighty men, but more than us. Oh, there's a nice koan there. I can feel it coming. the Bodhisattva of compassion has 84,000 hands and as many eyes. That's the tradition. So Yun Yin, who was one of these sort of ancient Zen figures, and Dao Wu, another ancient Zen figure. Yun Yin asked Dao Wu, "How does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes?" That's the question in the koan. Yun Yin was famous for apparently not lying down for 16 years or something. For what that's worth. And Wu said, "It's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night." So the question is, how does the Bodhisattva of great compassion use so many hands and eyes? And Wu said, "It's like someone reaching back, groping for a pillow in the middle of the night." That's part of the story. That's just so great. That's Cohen style. Just out of reach, but delicious. Let me give you a little history lesson, those of you academics and historians amongst you. In the early Buddhist, in the early Indian Buddhist tradition, bodhisattvas had a slightly different function in the kind of cosmology of multiple lifetimes and karma and cycles of existence. The only people were trapped in kind of the suffering of life endlessly, until they one day progress to being bodhisattvas, which are kind of Buddhas to be, kind of trainees, people who were mythical figures who developed great powers often and had particular qualities. And when they became Buddha in that kind of mythical arrangement, then they were ready to leave the cycle of existence of birth and death altogether. So there were many Buddhas. Well, not so many, but anyway. Buddhas were still kind of miraculous figures, but they were the sort of end point of this tradition, of the cycle of existence. They then could enter Nirvana, which in that tradition was interpreted as a kind of blowing out of the candle. And before they became Buddhas, they were regarded as sort of aspirant Buddhas, which are called Bodhisattvas. And that's all very much part of the Indian worldview of the time. The early Buddhist tradition, again from about 500, just more than 500, what we call BC or BCE, the Buddhist tradition adopted most of that worldview. It was only with the later development of what we call the Mahayana Buddhism from about 300 BCE, that the figure of the Bodhisattva underwent a kind of metamorphosis. And in the Mahayana there were a number of developments of which this was a part. In terms of spiritual practice, the classical Indian sense of obtaining each person practicing and obtaining enlightenment was broadened to include enlightenment for others. That I can't Enlightenment, by definition, can't be just for me. It has to be broader than that. So I don't practice for myself. Socially, the tradition widened to include males and females. That had already happened, which was quite unusual at the time. But it also included lay people and not just monks and nuns, not just ordained people. So socially there was a broadening of that. Philosophically, the notion of emptiness came to be a central concept in the philosophy of Buddhism. And the Heart Sutra that we chant every morning is the kind of core text of that development. Everything is empty. I'll come back to this in a moment. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That's philosophically that. Well, there are two aspects in which it's relevant here. I mean, it's such a vast concept that I don't think we can pretend to pin it down. But there are various facets of it. And one is that everything, every what we regard as a discrete individual thing or person is in fact just a moving node in the web of this inconceivably wide and multidimensional life process. But at no stage can we pin something down and identify it, label it, and store it in a museum, as it were. Each thing is just simply a node in this great web. And this came or fitted in with the early Indian Buddhist notions of impermanence, or emphasis on impermanence, non-self, and so on. So when they use in the Heart Sutra words like emptiness, like nothing, like no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, it's not pointing so much to an absence of the capacity for sight or of eyeballs or something like that, but just that when one enters things so deeply, all of that is just a part of this revolving, flowing, changing life of which we ourselves are part. That sort of thing. And then the last of the great changes in the Mahayana was the development of compassion as a central tenet of the tradition. It fits in with the broadening of things, with enlightenment, not just for me, and with something else, I can't remember what it was now. Anyway, they all belong together, this whole sort of set of developments of the tradition into what we call the Mahayana, of which Zen is a part. And it was the Mahayana tradition that traveled to India and Japan and South, at least certainly to China and Japan, most notably. Not exclusively, but those were the most influential kinds. And the figure of compassion, the centrality of compassion, and the mythical figure of Avalokiteshvara in India traveled with Buddhism into China and Japan, and especially at a kind of a parish level, it became a central figure, much more immediate and at hand than the Buddha himself, the historical Buddha, who kind of receded a bit. So that's just by way of background. It's really useless information. But anyway, there you go. You've got nowhere else to go, nothing else to do. So in the story, the question is, this great bodhisattva of compassion, this great with 84,000 arms and eyes, how does she use them, the one translation? How does she use them? And then the answer given in the story is, it's like reaching back in the night for your pillow. And that's just pointing to a kind of a spontaneous, unself-consciousness in our lives. That compassion as an idea is, of course, a lovely and often inspiring one. But as an idea, it's not enough. That's the kind of Zen style of it. Compassion is fine. You can talk about compassion all day, all night, until the cows come in to milk. But our practice is to embody it, to go beyond the word right into our lives. And not just into our lives trying to align ourselves with some idea of compassion. Not giving ourselves instructions to be kind and compassionate. Not trying to measure up to some ideal we may have of who is compassionate. Mother Teresa, Thich Nhat Hanh, Jesus. Our practice is, there are two aspects. One is that we're not trying to align ourselves to any idea, and we're not trying to align ourselves with our idea about anybody else. But how can we find our own embodiment in this moment? So the question has the idea that's a kind of koan in itself. How do we go beyond that question, the idea in that question, and find the embodiment? And not just embodiment as an idea. So it's endless. It's finding something spontaneous and natural, and it's finding it for ourselves, whatever it may be. So that the practice, what we talk of the practice of compassion a lot. It's one of our sort of inspiring hallmarks. And each night we recite, wherever there is suffering, I vow to open my heart. More traditionally, however many people there are and beings there are in this world, I vow to save them all. So, our practice is to go beyond those words. We take those words, they can inspire us, they can guide us in some way. But at some point we've got to take off our shoes and step into our own life and find it there. And to find it not only in the grand gesture, the philanthropic gesture, but in these small moments of our lives where we don't usually associate ideas of kindness, of compassion, generosity. But to go beyond those notions into something that at every moment we can embody. Something that arises out of giving ourselves to this moment. Something that arises out of the intimacy of having given ourselves away and being here with somebody. So the sense in our practice of compassion in particular, is not that we are trying to judge which action is correct compassion, which is not correct compassion, that sort of thing. That's just going back outside the door, putting not only our shoes on, but our slippers on over them. It's more finding for ourselves, giving ourselves to each moment so completely that we find ourselves adrift on the intimacy and relatedness of that moment, whatever it may be, and acting from there. So that what we recognize is a kind of spontaneity, an unself-consciousness, a lack of self-regard. That underpins the actions rather than what the particular action is. So right now you are listening and I am talking. How do you embody compassion in this moment? How do I embody compassion in this moment? How do we even go beyond any notion of compassion? What is my life at this moment? What is my life at this moment? This morning, Graham came to borrow a mirror for shaving. He lives out in the kopjes. He hasn't got a mirror, so he wants to shave. Not that I notice. Anyway. So he borrows an old antique mirror that actually came from my grandmother. And Margie hands it to him, and Graham promises to look after it with great respect. That's lovely. And Margie says, and don't forget to look after with great respect the face in the mirror. And Graham suddenly gets it, laughs. Just a wonderful, ordinary interaction full of heart. Your listening is full of heart. My talking is full of heart. That is like reaching behind you in the middle of the night for your pillow. It's just there. So simple, so tender, so complete. And of course, like everything else in our lives, we mess up, we continually, our hearts harden, we pass judgment, we miss opportunities for generosity, we do all of that continually. That's why we're here. We come here because of because we know that there's a life that we're still desperate and longing to connect with. And this is part of our honoring that, to just try and do it better. And however much we separate ourselves and harden our hearts or get stuck in judgment of others or ourselves, any of that kind of thing, that's where we start. We can't start anywhere other than where we are ourselves. We start just there. just there, in the natural, spontaneous humility that comes from realizing you've made a mistake. Just that natural willingness to start again and do our best. So we come, we sit, we get up, we listen to the tok 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 of the moktak in the morning, listen to the gongs and bells, sit down. Our practice is not to sit like stones on a cushion. Our practice is to use this opportunity to just find that ordinariness and naturalness and loveliness that we know to be part of ourselves. And when the retreat is over, that's what we take with us back into the world. So, thank you for listening. Thank you for sitting together. May your cushions be clouds. Thank you. So let's just sit quietly for a few minutes and we'll take it from there.